Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, August 12th. I'm Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, working to bring doctors closer together to collaborate and closer to the hospital to improve patient care. I trust saratogahospital.org for information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. R. Clement Darling of Albany Medical Center. He heads the hospital's division of vascular surgery and is in the studio to answer your questions. We usually get a lot of calls on this program, so call early if you intend to call at all. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, that number, 800-348-2551. Dr. R. Clement Darling, and your calls coming up on Medical Monday after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. R. Clement Darling of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Clement Darling heads the hospital's division of vascular surgery. He specializes in arterial insufficiency, aortic aneurysms, and arterial bypass, to name just a few. Dr. Darling earned his medical degree at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And our number to call if you have a question is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ray.
All right, let's start at the beginning. What is arterial insufficiency and why should I be worried about it?
Okay, arterial insufficiency is essentially hardening of the arteries.
The blood
vessels can get narrowed over time, most commonly due to smoking, and they can have less red cells going down, which carry oxygen, and so you can be more more prone to ulcers and other problems. Also, it can affect your cerebral circulation of the blood supply to the brain, where you can end up with a stroke.
Ah. And you have been doing this for quite some time, I understand.
Yes, I've been in Albany for close to 29 years right now.
And how did you end up in Albany?
Well, originally I was coming to Albany for 1 year. I was going to go back to Boston to do liver transplants. And Dr. Dharaj Shah, my senior partner, convinced my wife that it was better to not do another year of training in transplant, so I stayed here. And after that, the volume of business here has been so great that we decided to make this our home.
And you like it?
I love it.
It's worked out all right.
Yeah, love my job, love my partners, and I love my wife too.
And how many surgeries a week will you do?
I think our practice does somewhere between 40 and 60 surgeries a week.
Wow.
So we cover a lot of area. We've developed a network where we send most of them, the sickest patients from many of the hospitals within 100 miles to Albany Med.
Mm-hmm.
So we've developed a kind of a hub-and-spoke system.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's part of the process I'm working with the American College of Surgeons and our national society, the Society for Vascular Surgery, to accredit hospitals for vascular care and make sure the right patients get the right procedure in the right hospital.
How long have they been doing bypass surgery?
Albany Med actually has had a very stellar history with bypass surgery. Dr. Bob Leather and Alistair Carmody in the 70s and 80s brought back a technique called the in situ bypass from Norway, and Albany became known as one of the pioneers in distal and leg bypass surgery. So many of us came here to be trained by them, and then Dr. Dharaj Shah took over the program, and then I took over the program from them.
Now, when you say leg bypass, you're taking a snip of a vein or an artery from the leg and moving it up.
Well, that was the interesting part. Yes, we use the vein as an artery. And around the world, before Dr. Leather and Dr. Carmody took this technique, we used to take the vein out, turn it around because the valves got in the way. But they developed a technique where you leave it in situ, just being in its bed, so you didn't disturb the blood going through it. They developed instruments to cut the valves or disrupt the valves, and so you could sew the big vein to the big artery and the little vein to the little artery. So it was a revolutionary technique that was designed here and then was used around the world.
The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling is our guest. Has the state of the art changed in the last 30 years in bypass surgery?
Well, one of the beauties of vascular surgery is we essentially take care of all the blood vessels from the base of the skull down to the tip of the toes. So techniques have changed. There's been more development in minimally invasive techniques using stents and balloons and wires. And there have been technical improvements in open surgery. We still do a fair amount of open surgery as many of the more complex patients who have failed some of the minimally invasive techniques come to our service.
Give me the minimally invasive technique that is the most prevalent nowadays?
Peripheral angioplasty and stenting. So what it means is you take a wire, you go into the artery, you pass the wire past the narrowing, and then place a balloon and open up the artery. And if need be, you place a stent, which is a scaffolding. It's also become very common for treatment of aneurysms in the aorta and the thoracic area, which is the chest.
Minimally invasive means you're going in under the arm and snaking in. I mean, is this something where you're out of the hospital the next day?
It's actually going through the groin, most commonly going through the groin or through the elbow crease. But yeah, you're in the hospital for less time, for a couple days. There are no big incisions, but it's all based on your anatomy. If we think it's a safe way to do it, we'll do that. Otherwise, people get a bigger operation. The trade-off is durability versus time in the hospital.
And success rate is about the same?
Success rate is about the same if the patients are selected carefully. Mm. And that's why you need to go to a system or a group that has a long history and knows really what they're dealing with.
Dr. Clement Darling is our guest today, and we'll take calls at 800-348-2551. Let's go to Arthur in Pawling. Arthur.
In 2012, I had a stroke. The doctors at the hospital said I needed a triple bypass. I did not get the triple bypass. I instead went to a clinic where I got chelation therapy. I went back to my cardiologist. He did all the tests, and he said that I now have the cardiovascular system of a 30-year-old individual, and at the time I was 70 years old. I'd like to know if the doctor recommends that I go back and get a triple bypass.
How old are you now?
72.
If your heart is functioning well and the last cardiologist you saw says you're doing well, I think you should stay with what you're doing. Chelation therapy was an interesting therapy that was used probably 20 or 30 years ago that had varying effects. You've had great results with it, but I would recommend that as long as you're not symptomatic, you don't get short of breath, don't have chest pain, and you see a cardiologist to get checkups, you probably do not need coronary artery bypass surgery.
What is chelation therapy?
Chelation therapy is when they give a chemical that would bind in your bloodstream and takes and sort of, I guess, filter it, as for lack of a better term, take out some of the toxins. Again, it worked in some people, but it did not work in everybody, and that's why it's not become a standard therapy at this point.
What sort of toxins will it remove?
Well, you know, the number one factor for atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries is smoking. Second probably comes in more genetic problems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, high blood pressure, hypercholesterolemia, all of those cofactors. So it really binds cholesterol, binds some of the other cofactors.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling heads the Albany Medical Center Division of Vascular Surgery. 800-348-2551, the number. Let's grab another call here before the first break. Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Do omega-3s have any effect on deep vein thrombosis once it's formed?
Not really, Doug. Omega-3s are best for either stabilizing plaque or decreasing atherogenesis or the beginning of vascular disease. So it really doesn't have an effect on a deep vein thrombosis once it's occurred.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim. Our number is 800-348-2551. All right, that was quick. Let's do another one. Roger and Heath. Roger, you're on.
Yes, I have a client. I work for a community mental health center who was headed for cancer surgery. But in the course of that diagnosis, it was discovered that he has an ascending aortic aneurysm. But the cardiologist who diagnosed it told him it's not to be worried about. Seems to me that if you have a bulging aorta, it's something to worry about. So I was wondering if there are degrees of aneurysms that you need to worry about and maybe you can let go?
Absolutely. So an aneurysm is when your artery gets twice the size of its normal diameter. So we tend to watch ectatic aortas or aortas that are bigger than normal. Once they get twice the size, they get operated on, usually in the ascending, that would be around 5.5 to 6 centimeters. So it depends on the size. One of the problems is these do not grow in a linear fashion. They kind of grow in, we say, a burst fashion, so you should have follow-up either with a special ultrasound called a TEE or a CAT scan. So it really depends on the size. Once it gets to about 4 centimeters, it needs to be followed closely.
Now, when you say ascending aortic aneurysm, there's also a descending?
Correct. The cardiac surgeons tend, for the most part, to deal with the ascending aorta.
Why?
Because it requires a median sternotomy replacement of that portion of the
Where's
aorta.
Where's it going? Why is it ascending?
It's ascending off the heart, going into the blood vessels, into the arch of the aorta, which feed the blood vessels to the right and left side of the brain as well as to the arms.
Ah.
Once it gets past the left subclavian or the artery going to the left, it's considered descending thoracic. And that's more of our territory. I tend to do a lot of work with the cardiac surgeons in helping replace that portion of the aorta, the cerebral vessels in complicated aneurysms, because nowadays we actually do a combination of open aortic surgery and what we call hybrid, we're using the covered stent grafts for the descending thoracic.
You know, this is a great show. We'll take a break here, 800-348-2551. It's great because the host very seldom knows anything about what the guest is talking about, but we'll play it by ear. We'll be back with more of your calls coming up. Thank heavens Dr. Clement Darling is the doctor, because if I was the doctor, there'd be a lot of dead people around. The number is 800-348-2551. He just explained the ascending and descending aortic aneurysms, and I think I would still fail the exam. But, you know, we're here to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. So you're from the Boston area, right?
Yes. I grew up in downtown Boston and did my training down there and thought I was going to go back there and spend the rest of my life.
You know, there's a disconcerting number of Red Sox fans around here. You know that? So you're probably right at home.
It's a pathology.
Let's go back to the calls, 800-348-2551. At Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi. No dead roosters.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Maybe a dead me. Genetically, my mother's side of the family, including my first cousin, who's now 73, have all had to have bypass operations. You know, you name it. My mother had double, there was a triple, there was a quadruple, there was a quintet. My cousin had three and a heart valve replacement, and he was physically active through golf. He played 18 holes a day. And I went in and had a calcium scan, which is not terribly accurate, but it gives you a range. I've had it done twice now, and both times I showed up in the bad 33 percentile. I don't have any symptoms. I'm very skinny. I weigh 150. And I'm 6 foot tall, and my arteries are rather large. So, do I go? I don't have a cardiologist. My doctor seems to think, well, my cholesterol's not good. So, what does a guy like me do next? I mean, in terms of vascular health, I've cut out all sugar and all cheese and all that good stuff. And my cholesterol still stays up, and I'm genetically predisposed to vascular problems. So, what does a person do in a case like that? I'm taking 40 milligrams of avoristatin. So you know, it's a conundrum.
All right.
Correct. You know, as I mentioned, you don't smoke, correct?
No.
Good, because that's, you know, people fall into a few categories. Either they have risk factors that they have poorly controlled, and it sounds like you've done a good job with that. Many people have a genetic predisposition, much like you said. You know, most of us, most cardiologists would rely on symptoms, but coronary disease can be silent. And if you have a good internist, I think that's one way to go. I personally would probably get a stress test at some point just to make sure.
All right, let me stop you. A good internist. Mm-hmm. My mother went to an internist. I have not been able to find an internist in Washington County or Saratoga County. They don't seem to exist anymore.
Yeah, that, well, I think you're at a high-risk group even though you're asymptomatic. I would talk to your family doctor they're talking to, and I, you know, personally, I would see a cardiologist, just have an evaluation. Because are you very active?
I was until last September when I found out that both of my shoulders had to be replaced.
Ouch.
So I'm not going to do that. I saw the x-rays afterwards. That's a whole other story. But the cardiovascular thing, I try to remain active, and I watch my diet, and I take the avoristatin, and yet I still show up poorly on a test. And I don't quite understand why. My great-grandmother had large veins, and apparently I inherited her large veins, so maybe it's not as bad as it seems.
Mm. Correct. Well, it depends on if you have just large arteries or you have atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries with narrowings. It doesn't appear that you're symptomatic, but unfortunately sometimes these plaques can have blood go underneath them that can cause a small narrowing to become a large narrowing. Functional test would be helpful.
Explain to me how a blood clot forms. I thought it was on the surface of the inside of the artery.
Correct.
And now I read that it's not. It's between the inside layer of skin and the actual artery itself, that the plaque builds up in that area.
No, if you know what a crick looks like, and a crick, when it comes into a bifurcation, it goes into two areas, a lot of junk and foam tends to form around that. That's essentially what happens where your arteries are, is that you have a low, as we say, shear stress, where the cholesterol tends to collect, and that forms forms a plaque, which looks kind of like a pimple on the inside of the artery, a yellowish kind of plaque. Many times, if it's a soft plaque, the blood can go underneath it and cause it to become much more narrowed. So that's why functional tests are probably better than just doing an EKG, because they would want to make your heart work a little more to see how it works under stress. So I would talk to your family practitioner to run this by them. But I think that may be something helpful.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call. Now, Mark's situation is an interesting one. He's limited. He doesn't eat cheese. He doesn't eat sugar. He's behaving himself. And yet his cholesterol numbers and lipids are off the charts still. I mean, is it a zero-sum game? Should he go back to the cheese?
No, I think since he may have a genetic predisposition, it's very difficult to bring that down with just risk factor modifications. And that's why those patients need to be observed a little closer.
But he's on a statin. Now, let's talk quickly about statins before we take the next call. Has a statin proven to prolong anyone's life at this point?
Well, a statin has proven, statin and antiplatelet agents, especially combined, have proven to decrease the incidence of stroke and myocardial infarct, heart attacks. Again, doesn't help all people. They are somewhat idiosyncratic drugs because many people get side effects such as leg cramps from them. So they have to many times try different statins in order to see which one works best with your genetics and with your blood.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling is our guest on this Medical Monday, and Chris is in New Baltimore. Chris.
Yeah, hi there. I'm 72. A couple of years ago, maybe more like a decade ago, I was diagnosed by my cardiologist with some of the markers of Marfan syndrome. I'm very tall, 6'8", but I was never skinny. I was never had the convex or concave, rather, chest that is typical. But I do have several other markers, and one of them is an ascending aortic aneurysm. We measure it, as you discussed earlier, every year, and it's well within the limits of what people look for. I have two questions. Number one is, I just want to check my understanding. If that should burst, which I'm not particularly worried about, but the two things you look for are a sudden boost in blood pressure and terrible back pain. So I want to see if those were two indications that you've had a burst aneurysm. Is that accurate?
Actually, it would be a decrease in your blood pressure. The increase in your blood pressure may cause it to burst. Because what happens is as the aorta gets bigger and you have form an aneurysm, the wall becomes thinner, and it's kind of like a balloon. If you blow a balloon big enough, it's going to pop.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a potentially fatal problem. If it's under 4 centimeters now, Marfan's usually affects patients when they're in their 20s and 30s, and as you get to your age. It's less common that they need to be fixed. Ironically, I was presented a case like this in the Mayo Clinic when I was there early last week, and we all kind of commented that at 70, usually Marfan's is the type of Marfan you has is probably relatively less lethal than others.
What is Marfan's?
Marfan's is a collagen vascular weakness, and it presents itself in patients who tend to be tall and they have long digits, long fingers, and they tend to form aneurysms. And their whole aorta, usually by the time they get to be 40 or 50, if they don't get it all replaced, it's they tend to rupture and die at an early age.
So 70 years old, he's doing very well.
You're doing very well.
All right. Now we go to Carolyn in Egremont. Carolyn, you're on.
Oh.
Hi. Okay.
Oh. Sorry.
That's okay.
I had a question about the effects of really hardcore chemo on the vascular system.
Well, actually, the effects more are concerning about the type of tumor or that you have than it is the chemotherapy itself. Chemotherapy can cause blood to be a little thicker, especially when you get dehydrated from it. But it's usually not, and they can cause troubles with the veins. But it usually doesn't cause significant peripheral vascular disease. What we have problems with is many of the tumors make you what we call hypercoagulable, which makes your blood thicker than normal.
I should say that this is 20 years out, and I'm just wondering what the implications are for stroke or weakening of. I have little tiny strokes in my fingers, if you know what I mean. They suddenly will burst. Little vessels.
Yes, that's a different pathology, and it's more of a venous pathology. But or it can be little flecks of calcium that come off your aorta. But by and large, the chemo doesn't affect you long term. Radiation really does. It causes a reaction within the artery, which tends to narrow it, but not chemotherapy per se.
Oh, okay. But just locally.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling, our guest today, and Tom is in Poughkeepsie. Tom, you're on.
Thank you. I'm calling about experience I had with my own heart. I was about 7 years ago. I had been going to a cardiologist because I had a history of heart disease in my family. So the cardiologist gave me all the tests, stress tests, nuclear stress tests, ultrasounds, MRIs. I even paid for a calcium test. And the calcium test was around 80, which was high. But other than that, I was perfectly normal. And I was working on it. I went out. Fortunately, MT was working out next to me, flipped me over. I wasn't breathing. I was blue. He revived me.
Can we revive your cell connection? Are you there? Uh-oh. I hope nothing bad has happened to Tom. We'll give you another second here. Are you there? Oh, he's a goner. I mean, his signal is obviously, I'm sure he's fine. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Clement Darling, our guest. Barbara in Amherst. Barbara, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So you did say tip of the toe. So, you know, I hate to go away from the heart here, but I my family has a history of aneurysm and stroke. And one of the things that has bothered me is varicose veins only on one side of my body. And my father had them. I remember noticing everybody has all this, but they live nice, long lives. Their blood pressure is low and they stay very, very active. But I have had stripping of my veins and I've had injections and they keep coming, you know, they came back. And I just wondered why they never really treat the cause.
Well, that's a very interesting problem because venous disease is somewhat underappreciated. But what happens is if you have a family disposition for varicose veins, about 90% chance, or 90% chance if you haven't, it's because it's been passed down by your parents. Varicose veins occur because the valves don't work well. It doesn't. The trouble is whenever you do vein stripping or any of the injections, you may not really take care of the problem per se. Many of these problems can be dealt with without doing any intervention by just wearing compression stocks, which helps the cath pump blood back to your heart and try to override some of the valvular dysfunction.
So just a preventative. Yeah, I wore all those things all the time. I've had four children.
Yep.
And so what you're saying is there's really no way to not have them return. However, I have to say I had a knee replacement last year, and I've just watched these veins grow.
Correct. And I think the thing you really worry about is not necessarily the veins getting big, because they rarely rupture unless there's an excoriated area over it. It is that you can get ulcers around the ankle or in the lower calf, and that's why you need to—
A little bit.
And that's why you need to keep wearing compressions. Because what happened is when the valves don't work,
the blood
pools at the ankle and the red cells die and the iron comes out of that. And that is very toxic to your skin. So compression stockings are probably more important than anything.
I wear them. I have to tell you. So basically, the stockings do what your valves cannot do.
Correct.
And can I ask you just one other thing?
Absolutely.
So encourage people to make sure that they get a cardiologist, because my brother, who's 70, asymptomatic, you know, nothing, happened to go to school late in life, and he went to the doctor, and they just sent him to Yale, a good hospital, and he had a aortic aneurysm ready to burst. You know, we are talking 5, 6, 7, nothing. Never would have known about it.
Mm. Okay.
And he had open heart. They fixed everything. And so he calls us all his siblings, and said, go find out what's going on.
Okay.
Sure. Actually emphasize that is, you know, the aorta lies right next to your backbone and goes up into your chest, or comes from your chest into your backbone. 80 to 90% of the aneurysms are picked up by tests looking for other problems, such as heart problems, such as back problems, or kidney problems.
Mm.
And if you have one, there's a 20% chance that you're going to have a first degree relative who will have a genetic predisposition. So it's very important that you get these looked at. And I think having a cardiologist or a vascular surgeon look at it is very important.
Barbara, thanks for the call. What is vein stripping?
Vein stripping is it's a technique where you remove the saphenous vein by putting a wire down it and using a device in the old days that would just remove the vein. Currently, what we do is we laser ablate the vein so that we can redistribute the vein into the deep system, out of the superficial system. Because what Barbara was describing is that when your valves don't work in the superficial system, you get superficial venous hypertension and you get bulging in the veins.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, many times you can treat this just with stockings and with conservative therapy, as long as they don't have any sequelae or problems secondary to that.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. R. Clement Darling of Albany Medical Center is our guest. It's Medical Monday, as you may have been able to tell. We'll be back with more calls coming up. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok. Dr. R. Clement Darling of Albany Medical Center is here today. And before we hit the home stretch, just out of curiosity, what is the most common surgery you guys do over there in your department?
Well, the three most common surgeries are repair of abdominal aortic aneurysm. That's done mostly with a minimally invasive technique or stent graft. Leg bypasses, we still do a fair amount of. And that's when we use the saphenous vein, as I mentioned, as an artery. Or we use a wire and a catheter and a balloon to open up the blood vessels. And probably the one we've done most commonly would be a carotid endarterectomy, which is removing the plaque in the artery in the neck to prevent strokes. So those three areas are the most common.
And how does one remove plaque from the inside of an artery?
So we can do it with a stent, but it's probably 9 to 1 that we've been doing it open. It's a small artery in a small incision in the neck. You clamp the artery above and below where the blockage is. We use a technique called the eversion technique, which is much quicker. We've done about 13,000 of them.
Wow.
Where you transect the internal carotid artery off of the common and evert it like you would roll up the sleeve of your jacket, pull out the plaque, and then reconstruct the artery.
Is that like turning back the clock for someone who has led a less than exemplary health existence?
Well, the most important thing is after we do our procedures, whether they be minimally invasive with balloons and stents or whether they be with open surgery, you need to really modify your risk factors. And they're the same risk factors that you have to modify for a heart healthy life. Stop smoking, number one. Keep your cholesterol and blood pressure under good control.
That really didn't answer my question. In other words, if you do that, is it in fact you're increasing the blood flow, right?
Absolutely.
And so it is essentially like going back before you did all these bad things.
Yes.
And if you started going to do the bad things again,
the chances of recurrence are high.
In 20 years, 30
years?
Yeah.
You know, the recurrence for carotid disease is actually fairly low. It's about 2 to 4%.
Yeah.
I think most of our patients, we try to educate well on how to minimize the chance of recurrence because of risk factor modification.
The carotid artery then goes up. This is one that goes up
into the base of the skull, into the skull.
I would think that the surgery itself, now you're clamping it off, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep blood to the brain?
Well, there's two things. One is the other side artery can supply the brain because there's a connection called the circle of Willis where the left side can go to the other side on the right side.
Automatically?
Yep, automatically. And during the operation, we tend to do the operation while the patient's awake under local anesthesia.
Oh, my God, that's terrifying to
think
about.
It sounds like something out of Braveheart, but it tends to work for us. And if if the patient has some issues, we insert a little plastic tube so the blood gets circulated while we're doing the operation.
Wow. Let's go back to the calls. I'm terrified already. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Hi. I'm 71 years old, overweight, diagnosis pre-diabetic. A few years ago, I noticed my shoes got tight, and then my feet and ankles were noticeably had edema, and I was very upset. I went to the ER when I observed that, and they didn't diagnose it. I went to my doctor. Likewise, they didn't diagnose it. And I was told to elevate my feet, and I went to bed with my feet on a cushion, and that seemed to alleviate it fairly significantly. But a couple of weeks ago, even with my feet on a cushion, I would get up with my ankles and feet somewhat swollen. So I'm concerned about that.
Sure. There's three major reasons for having swollen ankles. One is a central problem, which is if you're retaining too much fluid and your heart is not working as well as it should and not be as effective in pumping the blood out of it, that can cause a significant amount of swelling, and that usually happens bilaterally. The second is the venous component, as we talked about earlier, where the valves don't work. Sometimes it's also due to the fact that you have too much water on board or you're having too much salt, which then brings over some water. And the third is what we call lymphedema, which is the arteries carry the blood down, the veins carry the blood back, and the lymphatic system picks up somewhat the slack. One of the ways to differentiate that just by history is that when you go to sleep, you raise your legs, so therefore the venous hydrostatic pressure goes down. So in the morning, your legs should be better than they are after standing up all day. Lymphatic disease does not do that. That's they really the same size no matter what you do, and you lose the little bit of definition around your ankle. But I would, you know, being pre-diabetic and being overweight, I would also make sure that your cardiac function is okay. And you know, if that is okay, then again, compression stockings may help you while you're walking or hanging your legs down.
Mark, thanks for the call. Now to Joan in Glens Falls. Joan, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a heart patient. I have had my mitral valve prolapsed and had the open heart surgery on that. I have also slight enlarging of the heart. The last couple, 3 weeks, from standing on my feet, I have noticed from the knee up, probably halfway on the thigh, on the outside portion of the thigh area, there is like a burning sensation, and sometimes it will be somewhat painful, but not very often. Is this something that could be vascular, or is this something else?
Probably not vascular. You know, one of the beauties of my world is that vascular is essentially plumbing, and it's also demand. You know, so one of the reasons that you get pain in your legs from vascular disease is because you run out of blood supply. And when you have a narrowing in the artery and you walk, you require about 5 to 10 times the amount of blood flow as you do when you stand still. So if it happens when you're not demanding more, that's less likely vascular surgery. Vascular disease. It could be what we call neurogenic, or something to do with your nerves or your back, which is probably more common and sometimes difficult to differentiate between arterial problems and neurogenic problems. So no, it's probably not vascular.
All right, Joan, thanks for the call. And now, well, let's go to our wayward friend Tom in Poughkeepsie and see if his signal's a little better. Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't know how much you heard of my first call.
It was a long time ago. I don't remember much.
No, I heard. I think I heard most of it. The question was going to be about cardiac catheterization.
Yeah, it was about catheterization. I had been going to a cardiologist for several years. Took all the tests. Nothing. The only indication was a calcium score of 80. So nothing was recommended. Nothing done. And then I went down in the gym. Fortunately, I was revived by an EMT who was working out next to me. And took them 5 days to figure out what was wrong with me until they did a catheterization, and it found out that I had 90% blockage in 5 arteries. So my question is, you know, I was a walking time bomb. Why is the catheterization can't be done, especially with a high calcium score?
Well,
as a diagnostic.
Yeah, anytime we invade the artery, i.e. putting in needles or wires, there's potential for complications. So, and nowadays, actually, we have some non-invasive ways to evaluate it using CTAs or MRs in order to evaluate your blood supply. But I completely agree with you that many patients, much like the gentleman who called earlier, who may have a genetic predisposition, should get a physiologic test, which is usually when a stress test that you can do, and they can give you medication to pretend like you're walking, or they can walk you on a treadmill to see how you will functionally work and how your heart is when it's stressed a little more than just the daily life, because there's a many.
Yeah, I did that. I had that done about 3 times,
and they didn't show anything.
And a nuclear stress test as well. So
then it goes back to the concern that I had also, in the sense that you can have a 20% narrowing or 40% narrowing, and blood can get underneath that soft plaque and then make it a 90% narrowing or complete occlusion very quickly. So I think, again, going back to risk modification, but cardiac catheterizations is a important part of the armamentarium for cardiologists, and some are more aggressive than others. But you are very correct. You can have a normal stress test and still have underlying coronary disease.
Tom, thank you. I'm glad you finally got through. Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Clement Darling of Albany Med is our guest. Mike in Goshen. Mike. Oh, Mike, you sound very loud. Do you have...
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I'm calling. I want some information about diet and cholesterol. Traditionally, I've had a kind of a borderline high cholesterol levels in the 220s. I'm 57 years old, and I recently went on a diet, a keto diet. Surprising that, and I was surprised that my cholesterol hadn't gone up. Mm. In fact, it actually went down.
Okay.
And so, where I completely eliminated starch, breads, rice, grains, and all, you know, even beans. And I'm just curious why I can eat so much more and not have my cholesterol rise.
All right, Mike, we're going to turn you down because it sounds like you are literally in a freighter in the North Atlantic right now. So maybe you can answer that that question, Doc.
Yes, as I mentioned before, people's response to cholesterol and cholesterol medications can be very idiosyncratic in the fact that each person acts a little bit differently. Diet is the first way to try to treat hypercholesterolemia, a ketogenic diet or the keto diet that you're talking about doesn't work for some people, but it will work for others. Now, when people start going on any diet, the most important thing is they actually start watching what they eat. And I think that's probably why your cholesterol is going down, is because you're being much more structured in what you eat and you're acknowledging that there are certain foods that are good and certain foods that are bad. If it's going down, that's a good thing. I don't want to get into the biochemistry of it all, but I think you should, you know, the goal should be to modify your risk factors, modify your diet, try to keep as active as possible, and that is the best way to protect your heart.
Let's go to Susan in West Stockbridge. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I was calling to talk about me, but after hearing the man about the catheter, if we have time, we could do me and my boyfriend. If not, we'll just do him. He's got AFib. And he's on a bunch of meds, and we saw a cardiologist who, I'm sorry, is leaving his practice, and he said he'd really like to see him come off the amiodarone, and he suggested a catheter. He did have a stress test, a nuclear, and two doctors read it, and one thought he had had a mild heart attack, and there was significant blockage, and the other one said, I don't think you did, and not so much. But he said, since there is a debate, I think we should find out if there is some blockages that could be causing the AFib. And now it sounds a little scary, like going in and damaging the arteries. And then they said that maybe if there's no problems, then he should get ablation.
Correct.
How long will he be out of commission? They're going in through the wrist. How long will he be out of commission with a catheter?
Yeah, this is more for a cardiologist than for a vascular surgeon. But again, the techniques have improved. We're dealing with two different pathologies. If it's an AFib due to a conduction problem, which is an electrical issue, then the ablation actually works very well, and they're usually back to work fairly quickly. If it is due to an ischemic problem, meaning the heart's not getting enough blood, that's another issue, and that would be with potentially balloons or stents or an open heart operation. And that lays them up a little bit more, although the stenting procedure she should be back relatively soon, depending on how many stents they use and what kind of other medications they give him. So he needs to be evaluated to rule out first that there's no blockage in his heart, and then you can look at the ablation technique.
What's the average post-surgical stay for your patients? Across all different procedures.
Yeah, it depends. You know, carotid surgery, which we do open, as I mentioned, for the most part, are usually in the hospital one day. If it's in a minimally invasive technique, many times we do it actually in our office, and they go home the same day.
Hmm.
If it's for aneurysm disease that's done in the hospital, they're in minimally invasive, it's usually 1 to 2 days. If it's open, it's usually a fairly extended hospital stay of probably a week or so.
If you had your druthers and insurance companies were not involved, would those post-surgical stays be longer?
We've been lucky at the medical center that we've had such a busy service that they haven't pressured us to get people out early.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part we find is getting them into the appropriate rehab if they need to, or getting home services just for lack of availability. The insurance companies haven't again, haven't pressured us too much to get him out. We could even actually lessen some of the times if the technology improves.
Well, you should be a politician. You are smooth, Doc. You are smooth. Patty in Pittsfield. Patty, you're on.
Hi. I have neuropathy in both feet, and in the last year, my right leg has become very not numb, not like the neuropathy, more like a very distinct pain, and it occurs mostly at night, wakes me up out of a dead sleep. And there's history in my family of heart disease and stroke and diabetes, and I have good cholesterol and eat right and all that baloney. I'm just wondering if it could possibly be something vascular as opposed to the neuropathy crawling up my leg, or
absolutely,
perhaps even something.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but absolutely.
No, go ahead.
It's what you're describing is a condition which is concerning called rest pain. You know, as I mentioned, blood vessels bring oxygen down to the lower extremity. When you go to sleep at night, your parasympathetics take over control, your blood pressure drops, and the amount of blood that's pushed out of your heart is less. And so when that happens, the portion of your body that's farthest away from your heart tends to get starved of oxygen, and that causes some pain. And then those people tend to wake up out of sleep, have to stand up, stomp their feet on the ground, their sympathetics take over, their blood pressure goes up, and the pain gets alleviated. If you don't take care of that in a relatively, within 6 to 12 months, that can cause problems. So you really need to be evaluated by a vascular surgeon, a board-certified vascular surgeon who can evaluate it. We can do the very simple, non-invasive tests where we put little blood pressure cuffs on your ankle, on your thigh, and your calf, and that will tell us whether the blood flow supply is adequate or if your leg is being starved of oxygen and lack of blood supply.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Patty. Now, you mentioned board-certified vascular surgeon. Are the non-board certified ones cheaper?
No, you get reimbursed the same. The way it works is there are two training pathways currently. You can go through 5 years of general surgery like I did and then do a two-year fellowship specializing in vascular surgery, and then you take an extra board, so you become board certified in general surgery and vascular surgery. Or now there's a new pathway where you can go 5 years straight of vascular surgery with some general surgery and only get board certified in vascular surgery. But when I was coming up, many other types of surgeons were doing vascular surgery, cardiac surgeons, thoracic surgeons, general surgeons specifically.
Right.
And so they started making the boards so that people would be would be taken care of by specially trained physicians.
And you're board certified?
I am board certified.
All right, sir. Well, listen, this hour has gone very quickly. Thank you for being here. Support comes from Hudson Valley Cancer Genetics, providing cancer risk assessment, genetic testing, and consultations for patients, survivors, and their family members, serving the entire Hudson Valley. HudsonValleyCancerGenetics.com. Thanks once again to Dr. R. Clement Darling at Albany Medical Center for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Even Tom in Poughkeepsie, who had to call 17 times to get through, it all worked out in the end. Thanks to our engineer, Rob Chacon, at the controls today. Thanks, Rob. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer, the affable Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, well, we've done something heavy. And then tomorrow we'll talk travel and vacations with Jean Gagnon. She'll be here to answer your travel questions right now. Stand by for the Media Project.